I'm delighted to introduce Janet Napolitano of the class of 1983, Secretary of Homeland Security, and the 2010 recipient of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Medal in Law. She is the third Secretary of Homeland Security and the first woman to hold that office. A few numbers will give you a sense of the scope of Secretary Napolitano's job. She is the boss of over 230,000 employees. Her org chart is 25 pages long, and she oversees an approximately $55 billion budget. The creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which involved the realignment of 22 different federal agencies, was the largest reorganization of the federal government since the creation of the Department of Defense in 1947. On a typical day in the department, the Bureau of Citizenship and Immigration Services will naturalize more than 3,000 new citizens. U.S. Immigrations and Customs Enforcement will make 10 currency seizures, totaling about $250,000, and participate in an average of 21 drug seizures. The Domestic Nuclear Detention Office will provide radiation detection equipment to U.S. Customs and Border Protection to scan more than 70,000 cargo containers for radiological and nuclear material. The Transportation Security Administration will screen approximately 2 million passengers and 1.8 million pieces of checked luggage. FEMA will provide funding, program guidance, and technical support to nearly 3,000 local community emergency response team programs. This list doesn't include the other activities of agencies within the Department of Homeland Security, which work together collectively on counterterrorism efforts, border security, immigration enforcement, and disaster preparedness, response, and recovery. Successfully managing an organization of that size and scope requires a rare combination of intelligence, persuasiveness, high-level vision, and attention to detail. Janet Napolitano has just that combination. At the law school, she caught the attention of her professors and fellow students even as a 1L. Her section mates recall her ability to zero in on the key points of assigned reading and her willingness to discuss them with anyone who was interested. They also note that she often mastered the next day's assignments quickly enough to get home and do a little non-law reading. After law school, Ms. Napolitano clerked for Judge Mary Schroeder of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Following her clerkship, she remained in Phoenix and joined the law firm of Lewis & Rocha, where she became a partner. In 1993, President Clinton appointed her U.S. Attorney for the District of Arizona. Her office successfully prosecuted Michael Fortier in connection with the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City. She also chaired the U.S. Attorney's Advisory Committee to United States Attorney Janet Reno. United States Attorney General Janet Reno. 5 years later, Napolitano formally entered politics when she ran successfully for the office of Arizona Attorney General. While in office, she created a computer crimes unit that prosecuted some of the first cybercrime cases in Arizona and helped to write a law to break up human smuggling rings. She argued cases before the United States Supreme Court and the International Court of Justice. In 2002, she was elected governor of Arizona. Her success in that post can be gauged by her subsequent re-election bid, which resulted in a landslide victory by 28 percentage points. As governor, she was recognized as a national leader on education, homeland security, border security, and immigration. Time magazine named her one of the five best governors in the country in November 2005. She also became the first woman to chair the National Governors Conference. Secretary Napolitano has taken a number of innovative approaches to countering the risks of terrorism, natural disasters, and other threats. She has worked diligently to expand information sharing among the myriad federal, state, and local law enforcement and disaster preparedness agencies. She has taken a proactive approach to border security by working with Mexican law enforcement agencies to improve interdiction of the drug trade and human trafficking. She has brought to the agency the same sophisticated appreciation of the promise and limits of technology that she displayed as a governor. The Department of Homeland Security's effectiveness, however, is most importantly measured by what does not happen. The plots that are deterred or thwarted, and the deaths that don't occur, in an earthquake or flood often remain hidden, often even to the department's own personnel. Secretary Napolitano has, in a very real sense, the ultimate thankless job. With such a demanding and critical job, one might expect Secretary Napolitano to be all business all the time. Not so. A well-known Monty Python fan, she is also an avid reader who can devour a book per day while on vacation. Her love for the opera is so well known that the Secret Service plays opera from her collection in her SUV. She has been to Bayreuth for the Ring Cycle. She has climbed Mount Kilimanjaro. Along with the governor of Sonora, Mexico, and his wife, she helped lead a two-day horseback ride called the Cal Bagada. She threw out the opening pitch at Yankee Stadium on September 11, 2009, although she is, of course, a rabid Diamondbacks fan. Please join me in welcoming Secretary Janet Napolitano.
Well, thank you. It's great to be back at UVA and back at the law school, and thank you, Dean, for that introduction. I did get to throw out the first pitch at the Yankees game, and I just wanted to be clear that it did go right over home plate, and it was a strike, so much to my surprise. It is always wonderful to be back in the land of Jefferson, even though I am a Westerner, really, by how I was raised or where I was raised. I was raised in New Mexico and have spent, obviously, my professional career until this most recent appointment in Arizona. But there's something very special about Charlottesville and the traditions here and the traditions at the law school. So I hope that particularly the students who are here today take full advantage of that and appreciate the very special time that you have right here at the law school. Jefferson was and had a very different introduction to the legal profession. He read law under George Wythe, who was at that time the most respected legal mind in the United States. As a law student, he was often invited to parties at the colonial governor's palace. I don't remember being invited to parties at the governor's office when I was a law student. I do remember being invited to Crozet Pizza and Courthouse Square. So it was a somewhat different experience. But one thing that people don't recognize, perhaps, is that Jefferson himself did practice what today would be standard commercial litigation for 7 years before embarking on his public career. He litigated land disputes throughout Virginia, and he was known to be a very skilled legal analyst and litigator. So he began his career in that sense, and through that, I'm sure, helped acquire even more skills that he would bring to bear in his later career in public service and all the myriad aspects that took. It's no surprise that when he founded the University of Virginia, he included law specifically as one of the subjects that must be taught in the academical village. Why? Because law brought with it so many of the powers of analysis, the powers of appreciation of different point of views, the power of the ability to form a narrative and to address people in an advocacy manner that he used later in his political life and indeed in his diplomatic life as well. Now, enough about Mr. Jefferson, let's talk about me. And The reason I raised about Mr. Jefferson is not only are we at the seat of his home, his traditions, but the notion that he went from reading the law, now there are law schools, but reading the law, to practicing law as a commercial lawyer, to public service, is very much a tradition that has continued throughout United States history and that I hope some of you are considering. And allows one to use this legal education that you receive in so many different ways. When I left here and drove to Phoenix to be a law clerk to a federal appellate judge, I literally arrived in Phoenix not knowing a soul. I had met my judge in a 20-minute interview in San Francisco, which is where the Ninth Circuit sits, but I'd never been there myself, and I thought I would spend 1 year in Phoenix before moving on to California, and ended up staying. And while I always had a notion that I wanted to do something in the public service realm, I also needed to pay off some loans, get settled financially, like many students do. And I went to work for a law firm as an associate and received excellent training there as well, because quite frankly, the training you receive at law school is nowhere near the completion of legal education. It's when you get into practice that you really begin to master the profession. And I had the fortune of working for a great firm and in particular being an associate assigned to our firm's senior counsel, who had in fact been involved in some of the significant Supreme Court cases of the 50s and 60s. He was fairly elderly by the time I joined the firm, but he had argued a case called Bates versus State Bar of Arizona. Okay, go look it up. And he had done all of the briefing, although he did not actually argue the case, but he had developed a legal theory and done all the briefing up to and including the Supreme Court briefs for a client of the firm's named Ernesto Miranda. And one of the great legal souvenirs that lawyers at that firm had is that some of them still walked around with the wallet card that contains the, police officers, they carry a wallet card that has the Miranda warning on it. And it's, usually a laminated card, but lawyers at our firm who were very senior had Miranda wallet cards with Ernesto Miranda's autograph on them, and I always felt badly that I never acquired one. The point being, however, is that I had the opportunity to be mentored in my beginning years of practice in a variety of ways and to participate in a number of litigation matters. Some straight commercial contract disputes, securities disputes, and the like. Some involving labor law, one case going all the way to the United States Supreme Court. And everything in between. It was the beginning, for example, of the litigation against the nation's blood banks about not protecting the nation's blood supply from a new virus at the time called AIDS. And why hadn't they recognized that earlier and protected the blood supply earlier, which gets into all of the notions or doctrinal notions that underlie product liability and all the rest. And so from that experience was able to expand what I had learned here. But at the same time, it wasn't enough just to be an associate at a law firm, ultimately a partner, but an associate, because I wanted to be doing more in the community at large. And that's a second point I'd like to raise, and that is the notion of lawyers, regardless of what kind of practice you have, as contributors to the community. So be it helping in legal aid, doing clinic work, being on the board of different organizations, and then doing political work as well. Now, at the time, I was decided that I would volunteer to help with the Arizona Democratic Party. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with Arizona Democratic politics, but in the early 1980s, let's just say, if you volunteered to help, you could advance very rapidly. There weren't a lot of people around, but it was great fun, and ultimately, of course, opened up many doors, because when Clinton was elected president and was appointing U.S. attorneys, which are the chief federal lawyers for districts, and Arizona is all one federal district. He looked around, and there I was. And that began really the first leap from a standard legal, law education, litigation, as varied as mine was, to public service full time. U.S. attorney job in Arizona, very different. I just met with the new U.S. attorney for this district, the Western District of Virginia. Very different districts, because in Arizona, you've got the southwest border. So you've got big drug cartel cases. You've got immigration work. That was my first experience with dealing with both of those subjects, and with dealing with the border and all the complexities that a national border has. In Arizona, unlike here, you have Indian country, lots of it. You have 22 tribes, and you are their prosecutor. You are their district attorney, as it were, because all felonies have to be prosecuted by the U.S. attorney. And that means homicide cases, sexual assault cases, kidnapping cases, and all the rest. And you also have lots of white-collar crime cases. This was the era of the big S&L frauds. Some of you may recall those cases, but they were big and important. They were the big white-collar cases of the time. And then, as the dean mentioned in the introduction, we had militia groups, and we had a big piece of the Oklahoma City bombing investigation. I want to pause a moment, and I got to tell you about this one case, because this was the Viper Militia. That's what they called themselves. And they were indicted because they had been driving around Phoenix with a video cam recording how they would blow up different federal buildings in the Phoenix area. And they had been infiltrated by an undercover agent. And we had been able, with appropriate judicial supervision, to put bugs, listening devices, and also a camera into the Viper Militia's meeting house or meeting room. Now, one of the things about militias is, for some reason, they have this thing about snakes and terrariums. And this is very common in militias to this day. I do not know why. Do not ask me. But it is a fact. And unfortunately, whoever our agent was that placed our camera put it behind the terrarium. So as the evidence was being put on at trial about what they were talking about during their meetings, you would see these snakes going back and forth across the lens. You would have thought it was a great visual, and you would have thought we'd planned it that way. The dive into electoral office was something very different indeed, because there you really have to make the decision that you are willing to go through a certain amount of stress, that you are willing to undertake, knowing that everything you have done will be subject to criticism or perhaps even ridicule. I mean, there are things that go into running for political office that, quite frankly, make doing it a tough decision. By the way, if you go back and read your history, you'll understand that it there were some similarities in Jefferson's day as well. And while they didn't have to deal with the blogosphere and the internet and the 24/7 news cycle, they also had to deal with a print press that was much more ideological and vituperative than anything really we see today. So Jefferson earned his political calluses, as anyone who runs for office or participates in the process does. But at that time in Arizona, I really thought to myself, I didn't want to be, you know, 80 years old and sitting on my porch saying woulda, coulda, shoulda. That if I was going to dive, it was time to dive. And into the waters I went. It was a great adventure. And of course, a successful one. And becoming a state attorney general was a great job, as was U.S. attorney. And so, as you begin to think of career options, this is also one where the lawyers in the office get to do lots of different things, but often fighting on the side of the angels, be it pursuing consumer fraud cases, be it prosecuting cases, depending on the office's jurisdiction. Be it representing the state in all manner of ways. It is not without its difficulties, however. For example, state attorneys general, in my case, different political party than the governor, but you represent the governor and you represent the governor's positions. And so the governor is your client. And unless you have a very, very, very uniquely strong reason for not representing your client, you almost are ethically bound to do so. And attorneys general across the country get caught in that on a fairly routine basis. In Arizona as well, we had a very active death penalty bar, and all death penalty appellate litigation and a habeas litigation was handled out of the U.S. Attorney's, or out of the Attorney General's office. And we had a number of executions while I did serve as the Attorney General. And those are just by the nature of that kind of work, extraordinarily difficult and must be done with extraordinary care. After a term, I ran for governor, and that, again, was a heavily contested race. I'll give you a little more details on that later. Suffice it to say that my opponent did not concede until the Sunday after the Tuesday election. And I'll tell you exactly where I was at the time. I was at a spa in California, and I thought I was incognito, and I was in a deep REM-type sleep, and the phone rang, and a man's voice on the other end said, "Good morning, Governor, this is your wake-up call." And to which I said, "I guess I'm being recorded." So, and like governors today, I came into office. We had a big deficit, legislature of the opposing party, both houses, and really working our way through that. How do you govern in that type of a situation? How do you move your agenda forward? How do you set your agenda? How do you know whether you're going to compromise on a bill or not? How do you make a decision about whether you're going to veto a bill or not? And all of those are the grist of the mill for anybody who serves as the chief executive. And sometimes we were successful. We were successful in implementing full-day kindergarten for every child in Arizona. We were successful in getting an initiative passed to fund preschool and child care for children in Arizona. We were successful in getting record amounts added to funding for our state universities and their faculties. We were successful in starting our own science foundation and in starting a second medical school for that young and growing state. But there were other things we were not so successful at and that were left undone when I received the call from the president-elect to come join the administration. But by definition, a governor's work will be left undone. A president's work will always be left undone. At a certain time, your term is over, and you turn it over to the next person. And they may want to focus on reversing what you did, amending what you did, or furthering what you did. And that is the nature of the political process. Let me close very briefly, because I really want to save our time for questions, and talk a little bit about the job that the president-elect asked me to take and that I willingly undertook. It is the newest department of the federal government. It is the third largest. It is, I think, other than the presidency itself, probably the Department of Homeland Security has the broadest area of jurisdiction because it covers everything from disaster relief mechanisms of FEMA to the Secret Service and the Coast Guard. We have a very interesting and active science and technology directorate that is doing all kinds of and funding all kinds of fascinating research designed to really try to imbue what we're doing in terms of protecting security with the most cutting-edge science and technology available. You'll begin noticing some of that at your airports because we are now moving into the next generation of screening technology, but we're seeing it at other places as well. We have a huge branch that deals with intel and analysis, and that is really focused on how do you take all of the information acquired by agencies, all of the various intelligence gathering agencies of the federal government, how do you take it and translate it into a form that you can share it with state and local law enforcement across the country and indeed with the private sector in certain circumstances so that they know what threat streams to watch out for. In this respect, we're not about investigating criminal cases. I mean, that's the FBI, that's the Department of Justice. What we are about is identifying threat streams, threat tactics, and methodologies that might be used either by al-Qaeda or al-Qaeda affiliates or indeed our own homegrown terrorists so that law enforcement knows what to watch out for and indeed the private sector knows what to watch out for and is better empowered in how to protect itself. But some very interesting and important work being done in that area as well. I came to Charlottesville yesterday in order to have dinner at Monticello, straight from a meeting in Abuja, Nigeria, of ministers of justice, interior, and transportation from 30-plus African nations because we have taken what happened on Christmas Day and have converted it into the opportunity to really open the global dialogue on what we all need to do to keep the global aviation system safe. A methodology we hope to use more and more as we approach different kinds of threats against us and indeed against the community of nations. And that is a lot of the work that we have ongoing right now. It is a job with immense variety to it and immense importance to it. I have taken one of your own, Professor Martin, with us at the department as the Deputy General Counsel and really Chief Counsel on all matters related to the very complicated, I think was maybe the right word, David, to say, issue of immigration and migration policy and law and enforcement. What do we need to do on the legalization side, but also what do we need to be doing on the enforcement side? The president is very committed to the idea of reforming our nation's immigration laws, and how do we get that done as well? So I guess I would call that the political side of the problem. An area that I've had a lot of experience with, beginning with those border cases in 1993 up to and including now. But it all goes back to Mr. Jefferson. It all goes back to a little bit right here in this very hall, and it all goes back to the education I was privileged to receive right here. So I want to again thank the university for inviting me back. Thank you for the recognition last night and midday today, and wish all of you the best as we all move forward. So let me stop, say thank you very much, and then we'll head on to the Q&A. Thank you very much.
If you will just get my attention, I will call on people.
Or I will call on people. Who's going to be first? There's one right there.
So what did you value as a Westerner, having been in Virginia for 3 years, in your career? What did anything about going to school in Virginia really help you or hurt you as a Westerner?
Well, when I was here, the question is, did anything at UVA help me or hurt me as a Westerner?
The geographic difference.
The geographic difference, yeah.
Going to a good law school.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll tell you, there are some, you know, laws different state to state, and so some of those subjects are not really immediately transferable. Doesn't matter, you learn it all in the bar review class anyway. I think when you practice in a state like Arizona, many of the lawyers went either to the Arizona State University Law School, now called the Sandra Day O'Connor School of Law. Sandra Day O'Connor, of course, being a quintessential Arizonan, the University of Arizona School of Law. So they had, you know, kind of those networks developed. And so much as in Virginia, there's a University of Virginia, I'm sure, network. But there were people who had gone to UVA. I think there were half a dozen people from my class who went to firms in Phoenix right after graduation. Harvard, Yale, Stanford. There were others as well. But so you got to, that's a difference that has some, you feel that when you're just starting out. It really dissipates over time. That's just a difference. But the one thing, and I said this in an interview just before this talk, that has really been important to me, regardless of what job I've had, regardless of what position I'm holding, some of the bonds forged here at this school with my fellow classmates, particularly in my small section, are bonds that these are still extraordinarily close friends, even though we are geographically spread, practice spread. People are in Seattle and Atlanta and Washington. My moot court partner was in a year ago in Los Angeles, where after a successful career as ultimately head of the fraud division of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Los Angeles, a Superior Court judge, trial court judge in Los Angeles, and I persuaded her to join the Department of Homeland Security as my senior counselor. So her office is now literally right next door to mine. But those bonds are really quite strong, and I would urge you to maintain them over time, because through thick and thin, they are there. It's a special thing. Who else has a question? Yes?
All of us, I suppose, are worried about the level of hate rhetoric, scary rhetoric, threatening rhetoric that the group runs through the windows of all the Congress. Do we need more legislation in the area of hate speech, threatening speech, scary speech, people taking guns within a couple hundred yards of the president speaking? Or is it just a matter of better policing to make sure something is pulled?
The question was, in light of the intensity of the rhetoric this spring, do we need more laws about hate speech and the like, or is it a matter of enforcement or what? I think we should look at it from a few different angles. One is that throughout our country's history, we have gone through periods of very exacerbated and intense and heated rhetoric. I'm reading a book now called Supreme Power by a fellow named Jeff Schessel. It's about FDR's attempt to pack the Supreme Court. And you know, you're actually almost a third of the way through the book before you get to the actual court packing plan. But as you read the first third of the book, what's interesting is that as FDR took over the presidency and they passed the NRA, the epithets hurled at him, the kind of rhetoric that was out there is very similar almost to what we heard in the immediate aftermath, say, of the health care bill. And in fact, I was reading the book one night, and if you'd have blocked out the dates and the name FDR, you'd almost have thought you were reading something about today. It's that similar in a way. So we've always had it. Maybe we don't like it, but we've always managed our way through it with the appreciation that our country is a country where the freedom of speech, the freedom of expression is our basic, is a basic embraced value, particularly political speech. Where it becomes more difficult is where it begins to cross the line into actual planning for violent activity and the commission of violence. And that's difficult because sometimes you just don't know. Sometimes it is not easy to know at the outset whether this is just ultra-heated rhetoric or if, in fact, this is a group that's going to blow up a bunch of buildings or attempt an assassination or the like. And that's where you have to exercise judgment. You have to make decisions about what tools are at your use and how they can be used, and then use them properly. There are difficult judgment calls made every day in that regard, but they are judgment calls about what can be anticipated about certain types of human behavior, not about the law itself. So it's not that the laws need to be changed, in my view, or that we need different types of laws. What we need is to make sure that within the enforcement community, we've got good experience, folks on the ground, folks in supervision, and folks making judgment calls who can bring experience and judgment to bear on what are oftentimes very, very difficult decisions.
I'm a student in the immigration course this semester, and we've been tasked as part of the course to think about the current policies behind immigration law and how these policies may be changing. So in light of that, I wanted to know what we should be expecting from the Obama administration currently as far as the areas that he wants to focus on in immigration policy, whether there will be any kind of significant change or what direction that would be going in.
Yeah, I think actually there have been already been changes that are fairly significant in nature. For example, we have, you know, there are literally millions of people in the United States who technically are subject and legally are subject to removal and removal proceedings. The priority that has been set is one that I think is one that not only embraces immigration law, but also good public safety practices as well, so that we are focused on removing those who have committed serious felonies. And also those who are felony fugitives who have been apprehended. Our numbers in terms of those types of removals are up significantly over the last 2 years of the prior administration. So that's one area, is really focusing on we know we need to remove. We need to enforce the immigration laws, but how you prioritize within that is important, and so that's where the priority has been set. A second area is in the area of worksite enforcement. There was a lot of controversy at the end of the prior administration on so-called worksite raids, where immigration ICE agents, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the acronym is ICE, would descend on a place and arrest a lot of people and remove them. We have gone about worksite enforcement in a different way. By the way, I think worksite enforcement is important. Why? Because most illegal immigration is driven by economics, and you've got to deal with the demand side of that as well as the supply side. So you've got to deal with worksite enforcement in the interior of the country. But where the focus has changed is in methodology rather than raids. We are doing audits of companies. They're called I-9 audits. And the I-9 audits, reveal whether a company, an employer, really should be subject to a subsequent criminal investigation. The idea, of course, being that there ought to be a case against the employer, as well as removal of employees. Now, this is made difficult because the actual criminal law on employers is not very helpful. I think it was written by the employers. To prove a case, you've got to prove not only that he knew the person he hired was here illegally, but how he crossed that he was illegal and how he crossed the border. And then even when you prove all that, the fines and sentences are not very significant, so you don't get the deterrent aspect of things. When the Congress takes up immigration reform, one of the things we'd like to have reformed is that section of the law.
Pam, I've heard the argument that one of the unintended consequences of our military engagement abroad is that we aren't having to fight them over here, we're fighting them over there. As those wars seem to be winding down, are you expecting more of a sort of threat here in America? Does that have anything to do with perhaps higher incidents of domestic terrorism?
I don't know that I'd look at it quite that way. Here's what I think we can say, which is Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, the most frequently spoken about now, AQAP, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, still have an anti-Western agenda, focus a lot on the United States. That to them is their goal. to disrupt with violence. And that they would like to take down a commercial airliner. That was something they were able to do before, and they'd like to continue or to try to do that again. Or something else. You may have seen in the press recently some accounts of a fellow named Zazi, who has now pled, but he was part of a conspiracy to use IEDs to go into subway tunnels, right? So different ways of coming at the United States through critical infrastructure, a lot of it transportation oriented. And that has continued, and it is it has morphed in the sense that we see more and more lone actors as opposed to big conspiracies. Lone actors are more difficult to find and intercept, greater use of non-traditional terrorists, if I can use that phrase. It's an awkward phrase, but for example, the recruitment of women now to act as terrorists. We're now seeing that as a methodology. And then, of course, the growth of individuals within the United States who, for reasons we don't completely understand, decide to travel to the Fatah or to Yemen, attend the camps, become radicalized, and also trained in violent tactics, and then return to the United States. And, of course, with U.S. citizens, our ability to interfere with their travel is more circumscribed than it is with non-U.S. citizens. So those are all things that we are seeing now in the threat environment. And maybe the thing just to deduce from that is that the threat environment is with us. It is constantly changing. We need to be agile. We need to be not just reactive but proactive. And we also need to understand as a country that this is probably never going completely away. It is something with which we need to deal. And then if something were to happen, to have the wherewithal to respond quickly and effectively.
Arizona.
Sure. Arizona. All right.
And come back. I have a question. I think they can see us.
Really?
And whatever.
When did that happen?
But my question for you is, we have a court full of judges, and I was wondering what someone, anyone with a political background brings to the court that a judge maybe could not.
You know, I think, in all fairness, I think I probably ought not to respond to those questions right now. The timing is just not apt.
Society is increasingly dependent on information technology. And as it gets, the internet gets more and more woven into our infrastructure, the risk increases of how much damage an attack could do. Are the laws on the books adequate for going after and the people who might perpetrate such things and protecting society?
No. The whole issue of cybersecurity, cyber attack, is an area where I think we're in our infancy, really, in terms of understanding any kind of a useful legal paradigm. And sort of your traditional paradigm, you know, tools that you would use aren't so useful given the global nature of the internet, given how it is set up structurally, given the speed with which it operates. I could go on and on and on and on. And so this is an area where I think the law is going to have to move much more quickly, and that the pace of that change needs to accelerate. We have actually, in our vision statement for the department, we've identified five issues, five missions that are key for us, and one of them is the protection of cyberspace. And it's the first time ever a major federal department has actually singled out protection of cyberspace as a major mission area. The connection with critical infrastructure in our country, telecommunications, utilities, for example, so very, very key. Much of that is held in private hands, and so we don't have direct control over that. Well, how do you do that? What should you require, and should you require it, or should you ask for voluntary participation in adhering to certain standards, and how should that be done to protect critical infrastructure? How we deal with the actual service providers, the servers themselves over which illegal or destructive information may be being transported, as well as perfectly legal information or material. So that's an issue. The globalization of the internet and the fact that it's not confined within the physical borders of the United States, and so you're almost by definition dealing in an international sphere if you're doing anything significant. There's that issue as well. Enormously complicated, I think an area where a lot of thought work still needs to be done. An area, by the way, where we are hiring, particularly individuals who have cyber technical expertise, but where people who have both legal expertise and technical cyber expertise are incredibly valuable, because we need, on our end of things, to accelerate our own pace and in cyber protection, cyber prevention, and the like. So, long answer to your question. If the question is, are the laws adequate? The answer, quite simply, is no.
I've got time for one more.
As you deal with the difficult problem of terrorism, how do you weigh and assess the important need also not to overreact either economically in expenditures or in civil liberties?
Well, I think it's it's not an easy answer, and it's not often a self-evident answer. One way is to build into our thinking from the outset thought about civil liberties and privacy protections. And so one of the first people I hired was an attorney in D.C. Who has been a leader in the privacy bar, and her work is built into a lot of our policy changes at the outset, as opposed to being shoehorned after we've already basically decided what we want to do. In terms of the kind of budget issue, how do you know you're not just, you know, spending a whole lot of money, and that's a difficult one as well. I'll give you a concrete example. After the Christmas Day attempt, We accelerated the deployment of what are called advanced imaging technology machines, AI. We call them AITs, others call them whole body scanners. But they are objectively better in terms of defining whether somebody's trying to bring something onto a plane that's non-metallic but yet destructive. And we didn't just decide about these machines after Christmas. In fact, we had already made the fundamental decision that they were so much better from a number of different aspects than the magnetometer that we were going to move them. We just made the decision to do it more quickly, but not to rely on them alone, to combine them with more canine teams, undercover behavior detection officers, explosive trace detection wands that can be run across the palm of a hand to ascertain whether it's been in touch with anything of an explosive nature, just to speed up what we had already decided. Now, you could argue that that was an overreaction. I would say no. It was taking a very sound policy decision and moving it proactively forward with the other things I've already outlined, and then putting it into an entirely new global framework so that it's not just about what we do in the aviation environment within the United States, but how we use this as a way to work with the countries of the world, the nations of the world, to improve security globally, pointing out that there were citizens of 17 countries besides the U.S. that would have perished on flight 253 if Abdulmutallab had been successful. So you're constantly making those kind of judgments, trying to seat things in an appropriate way, but understanding that the fundamental values that we embrace as American values, it would be contraindicated if we were to self-impinge on those values, even as we do our security work. So they are part and parcel of the way we address things moving forward. And I think, and I would hope that if Mr. Jefferson had to deal with this kind of issue today, I'm quite confident he would be doing the same thing. I hope. Thank you all very much.